to welcome today our speaker at our sort of event opening, our season opening event. We started events every year in October, and we wrap them up in summer with a good pause for around on. So we're very pleased to welcome our speaker. So Glenn Hutchings is, importantly for our purposes, a trustee of the Brookfield Institution in Washington. Basically, the oldest think tank in the U.S., born in 1916, and the largest of its kind. The purpose of Brookfield is to bring together business, government, media, academia, and NGOs to discuss pressing policy issues. And our goal here at the Brookfield Stovall Center is to discuss issues that are of importance both to the Arab world and the broader Middle East and the United States. And so we're very pleased to have Mr. Hutchings with us here today. To discuss with us the global economic crisis, what happened and what's next. Mr. Hutchings is the CEO of Silver Lake Consulting, a leader in large private investments in technology in particular, as well as other investments, and as I said, importantly, a trustee of the Brookings Institution. He's one of the directors of NASDAQ, director of Harvard University Management Company, which manages Harvard's endowments, and also importantly, he has 3 degrees from Harvard University, undergraduate, a JD, and MBA. So before we get started, and I pass to Glenn the parole, just to let you know, we'll conclude in 90 minutes. I'm going to take the lead in silencing my cell phone and demonstrate to you how I can do that. And hopefully you all can do, many of you can do the same, so that we can have a focused discussion. We are going to do this discussion all in English. We apologize. We do many of our events in Arabic or Arabic in English, but this event will be in English. And after Glenn will present for about half an hour, is that what we're here for? 20. We'll see. Glenn will present, and then we'll have a question and answer session. We have an American tradition in the U.S., which is that we eat while we talk. Maybe not an American tradition, but it is an American tradition that we record as Doha. So food will be served as Glenn presents, and he has kindly let me know that it's okay when you're eating when the food comes. So please begin when the food is served. And actually, guys, why don't we just have them begin to serve the food? That would be great. So I pass the parole to Glenn Hutchings.
Thank you. At the risk of contradicting my host right away, I would urge everybody, since I'm in the technology investment business, I would urge everybody to turn your cell phones on right now. Get out of the BlackBerry and let 1,000 pieces of technology boom in your room today. So I'm not offended by people eating, and I'm certainly not offended by people looking at their BlackBerry while I'm talking. So I mentioned my education. I finished college 32 years ago. I began a study of the global markets, the global economy, global markets, the influence of external factors like policy decisions on markets, in order to develop an intellectual property with which to make investment decisions. I've been working actively as an investor for 25 years. The events of the past year were quite stunning for me, as I'm sure they were for all of us in this room today. And I never thought that I would see this. Oops. You haven't seen it either. Here we go. Nope. You haven't. Not the dancing. Give us a second to deal with the technology here. Maybe I get this one. No. Oh, I got to read it. Yeah, good. That's okay. Just wait a second. So, let's see now. Is that over? There we go. Well done. Thank you, Suzanne. This is my colleague, Suzanne Ferrier, by the way. She actually knows something about the technology. I never thought I would see this. This is something I call the periodic table of worst ever economic indicators. So these are the economic indicators that over the past year got the worst ever on record. I never thought I would see a situation like this in my life. Right? And so in addition to not understanding why we ended up in this situation, it caused me to be very concerned that my basic instincts as an investor had been challenged. And I couldn't trust myself to make good investments unless I understood what had happened. So I went out and studied this, and I discovered three things. First was there are a whole bunch of things that happened in these, and that I was really, though I observed, didn't really understand very well, primarily in the U.S. residential real estate market, which I'll show you examples of in a minute. The second was that there was no one place to go for a comprehensive understanding of what had happened. In fact, to reverse the old joke, there were a bunch of people who had their arms around an elephant's leg and thought it was just a telephone pole. They didn't understand that what they thought that what they were doing was kind of isolating everything else rather than a part of a broad system that had systemic implications for the entire world. And third, if you actually did understand what happened, once you took the comprehensive perspective, you reached very, very different conclusions about what either the economic, investment, or general political conclusions were as a result of what the solution should be. And my view has always been if you don't understand the problem, you can't solve it. So first understanding the problem, that's critical. And then once I understood the problem better, I began to talk around the world to people about what the situation was and trying to make them understand it at all. So, first what we're going to do today is go to the root cause of the issue, of the crisis. The first root cause was massive mental clinics that built up around the world. I'll show you some detail about that later on. That liquidity flowed into two places. The first was the U.S. residential real estate market, creating a bubble of historic proportions. The second was pretty much everywhere else, which I'll show you. That inflated the bubble that began to deflate when Americans finally took on more debt than they could service and began to default on their debt before the onset of the recession. That progressive deflation of the bubble was turned into an event of catalytic and catastrophic proportions by the decision of Lehman Brothers failed about a year ago, which created what I call the panic of 08, and I'll show you what happened and why. And then we'll look at the policy actions that have been taken, so they're just getting good traction now, that have been taken to address the problem. Well, I was with Chairman Bernanke from the Fed a couple of weeks ago at Brookings, where he announced that the recession was over. Some of you might have read about that in the paper. So I changed this part of the presentation now to say the beginning had ended. The ending hasn't begun yet, but the beginning has ended, and I'll show you what I mean by that. And then we'll look at prognoses to a few. Well, the first thing that happened was, by the way, I apologize in advance, it's several things we're saying, God we trust, all of them bring data. So this is a very data-rich presentation. I'm not trying to offer opinions, I'm trying to show you the facts about what happened. Okay? First thing that happened, following the events of September 11th, 2001, central banks around the world cut interest rates to levels never seen before, 550 basis point easing, which meant that real interest rates less rate of inflation, were negative. So it was rational for investors to borrow as much money as they could and invest as much as they could because money was free. So they're going out of business bailout money. The second thing was there was a whole lot of money. Right? Being here in Qatar, I don't need to tell you about the buildup of money in the sovereign wealth funds in the oil producing countries. The buildup outside the United States is a similar, if not larger, phenomenon in the petroleum exporting countries. What happens where they manage their currency rate down very low to prevent runs from the currency like what they've seen in 1997, plus to affect their development strategies, building up huge industrial sectors in their countries. That meant that there was a massive buildup of foreign exchange reserves outside the United States, something Ben Bernanke called the global savings flood. Now, in the upper 30s, when we were on a gold standard, this would have been what's called sterilized. It would have been exchanged for gold, and cash would have been exchanged for gold and would have disappeared from the global system. But in a fiat or paper currency system, the money had to go back into the banking system with the consequences that we'll see later on. Secondly, these are the largest banks in the world. And they built up the assets. Deutsche Bank, Citibank, UBS, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, Credit Suisse, Goldman Sachs, Goldman Stanley, Morgan Stanley, Morgan. They put the asset position of their balance sheets from $6 trillion to $13 trillion. Now, those of you sitting in the back, can you see this tiny little yellow thing here? See that? It's kind of hard to see. It's so small, right? See that? That's their tangible book value. Right? So they took their multiple of book value on their balance sheet from 23 to 43 times. during this time period. Massive inflation of leverage on the balance sheet and lent up on the global economy. That's on balance sheet. Off balance sheet, there are these things set up called state structured investment vehicles that were, and this is the way they were structured. Deficit capital down 93% borrowed, a third of which was very short term in nature. That borrowing was done in the commercial paper market up in the right hand side of the state. They had a huge spike of $1 trillion in commercial paper on trade, two thirds of which was 1 to 4 days in maturity. So these capital structures were one third composed of liabilities that were 1 to 4 days maturity, and they were buying mortgages. Student loans, instead of things that were much longer maturity than 1 to 4 days. Just in the banking market alone, $400 billion of deficit debt was done off balance sheet, and another $1.3 trillion was done elsewhere in construction products. So, I'm going to skip through this one. So, imagine for a moment this massive deluge, waterfall, victorious fall of liquidity pouring into the global economy at incredibly low prices. Where did it go? The first place it was the U.S. residential real estate market. So, as a result of the liquidity pouring in the market, there was a massive and ongoing degradation in the quality of mortgages that were originated. The subprime multi mortgages, which were the lower credit quality mortgages, went from 10 to 40% of the stock of mortgages originated during this time period. Now, this is an interesting concept. There are some Americans here who understand the U.S. mortgage market. Who's an American here in Vegas? Okay, now, I always thought, some of you agree with me, I always thought that you had to pay your mortgage back. I mean, isn't that the idea, right? You can go get a mortgage and you get down to pay back. Other than your biggest only negative amortization mortgage, mortgages you could not pay back up to 25 to 29% of origination. Extraordinary. And during this time period, each graduating class got worse and worse. So each year, even as a fault curve, each year you went through the crisis and went through the bubble. No, each subsequent class had higher and higher subsequent defaults. So this is about 2005, this is about 2006, and this is about 2007. That's, by the way, the point that Mark made on the countryside, is it kept getting worse and worse during this time period. Now, this resulted in very large parts of the liquidity that came in, but it also resulted from the interference of the U.S. government and the discipline of the mortgage economy through the agencies of Fannie Mae and Freddie, you might have heard of, that had a huge quantum capital advantage over the private actors, forcing the private actors to find more profitable but consuming more risky places to make investments. And it's an example of the distortions of the private market by government action in the economy. Secondly, Americans went through a vintage consumption of historic proportions during this time period, but had those savings and stagnant median incomes. So where did they get the money to buy all the things? By the way, what I'd like to do is have questions along the way today rather than at the end. And he promised that BMW, the person who answered, ask the best questions. Okay? So please, if you have questions along the way, raise your hand. Let's have a little more of a dialogue then, and then we'll see who gets the card. Mortgage equity withdrawals. These are people taking money in their houses with the 10 to 12% disposable income per quarter. Drawing the equity content of the U.S. housing stock, which has historically been 75 to 80% down to 41%, the lowest on record. We took about a third of the value of our homes and just lit it on fire. Consumed it during this time. It's a great area to consume. Third, it used to be that the mortgage market in the United States was something called buy and hold. The bank would originate the mortgage hold on them. This is completely changed, and the vast majority of these assets that were originated were actually syndicated. 75 to 80% of the assets of the bad mortgages that were originated were packaged in securities and syndicated around the world, spread around the world by the swine flu. And who was the biggest player in that? The result of which is the U.S. The mortgage market went from being a buy and hold market with very low secondary activity. Here, massive spike in secondary market activity. So fundamentally changed the market. Nobody knew who owned the assets, who was responsible for them, where they were, etc. And who was the biggest player in that? Of course, it was the U.S. government in the dark blue. In the form of Fannie Freddie. Like any good government agency, Fannie and Freddie came in big, they came in late, and they bought all the wrong stuff. Right? They're completely exposed to the market. The result of all this was what I call the mother of all problems. U.S. residential housing crisis over time, this goes back to the Great Depression, then the ASF goes back to the Civil War, they increase less than 1%, about 0.7% annually, very steady, very low volatility. In 1998, that curve went up by a factor of 10, and housing prices grew by 8% annually. Right? Tenfold increase in growth rate in housing prices. That created standing up right here, this is something called the home price to rent ratio, which at equilibrium is supposed to be 1.0, which is about the same as the rent to house as the buy one. That's an economic equilibrium. We got to the point where it was twice as expensive to buy a house as to rent one unit. Right? Why? Because this increase was going to happen forever. Private house prices are going to go forever, so we had to buy. Right? But that's a fundamental equilibrium. Why is this important? This is important because this is a huge market. The U.S. home mortgage market is $10.5 trillion in size. If you the entire U.S. equity market is $10 trillion in size. We had a dot-com bubble collapse that was one slice of one market in Nasdaq. If you actually add in the commercial real estate, the commercial mortgage market, which runs 3.5 trillion, that's the same experience. We have a market 40% larger than the equity market, which is inflated. This is by a lot the biggest asset bubble in human history. There has never been an asset class this big. These are not tools. Right? This is not Mississippi swampland. This is one of the largest markets in the asset classes in the entire world that went through this inflation. Some other ball bubbles, okay? Second, where else did the money go? They went pretty much everywhere. Wall Street. Upper left, you can see the hedge funds. Everybody heard about hedge funds? Dark blue and hedge funds are their assets under management. Top of the bar is their total investments in the marketplace. What's the light blue? The difference? Leverage. So many of you are in the big banks off their balance sheets to leverage your position in the equity market. Upper right, global infrastructure product, 30% down, 93% bar, the further which is 1 to 4 days maturity, $1 trillion a quarter around the globe. Lower left, outstanding positions in the OTC derivatives market. OTC means over the counter. That means no central clearing, no exchange, no capital requirements, wild west. This is a $525 trillion, or 35 times the size of our GDP. Did you know that? How do you know that? I mean, think about that. Think about that, right? So the investing in an economic activity was 35 times the size of the underlying economic activity. And also, this is what I thought, technology is about a building black and very cool. You can click on any graph in the presentation to work. And it comes up for you to look at it, right? And so this is the U.S. financial services industry share of total U.S. business profitability. Historically, been 16%, the 90s went to 21 to 30%. Wall Street used all this leverage to drive 41% of business profitability for itself. Unsustainable and political dynamo. Okay? But it wasn't just Wall Street. Everybody hear that? Can I say it again? It wasn't just Wall Street. Great American consumer. A generation of consumption. Brand new BMWs in the driveway. Flat panel TVs in the den. Appliances in the kitchen. Closets, grocery full of clothing that they don't wear. Stagnating incomes, no savings. Just completely destroyed personal balance sheets. Total debt services, percent of disposable income was 15%. Sorry. 15% here, a level not seen since the Great Depression. Great American consumer completely destroyed their credit worth. U.S. government. Party bought right along with the rest of them, right? But in two wars of national tax cut and no time spending. One of the things Clinton did not say was that the honor to serve in the Clinton administration in the economics team. And you see that blue up there, Hottie? See that blue stuff up there? Those circles? That was my team. By the way. And so we ran naturally got the deficit. You can see here the projections as a result of stimulus spending. Current account deficit. Remember, we're buying all this stuff. We can't get ourselves organized to make it, so what happens? We import it. We're not generating any savings in the United States, so we have to borrow it. It used to be that the IMF would intervene in a country in the matter of economic crisis when its trade deficit got 5% of GDP. That was an alarm bell. You can see that the United States blew right through 5% except on going during this time. The economic behavior never seen in the developed country. All that's capital deployed from outside the United States to Memphis, as a result of which, at the end of this period, 60% of U.S. Treasury securities were owned outside the United States. Regulatory credit. I did this on the presentation of the U.S. Naval Academy, 150 midshipmen and women studying economics. And they said, they asked a really interesting question at this point. Someone said, Mr. Hutchins, what are ratings? That's really interesting, right? And I said, you know, when I came on to your base, the analysis of the base, when I came on your base, there was a sentry at the guardhouse who asked for my credentials to check in. I said, yeah, so lots of ratings. So I the people who keep the bad guys out of the global economy, completely self-quit. In January 2008, there were only 12 AAA rated companies in the entire world. But I thought you'd say, why? Did you know? But 64,000 structured products were deployed. Imagine that. I didn't know that. Think about that. The AAA rating completely lost its meaning, right? Isn't that incredible? Right? The result is, well, you can see here, now I'm just a student of human behavior. This chart shows in the blue the total asset-backed securities issuance during this time period, and the red is the bullish profits per employee. It seems reasonably correlated. Widespread regulatory failure. Key markets were unregulated, private mortgage insurance market, private mortgage market, and the over-the-counter derivative market, which you see. The insurance industry was lightly regulated, very regulated in the state level, state competing with the insurance companies. Basel II capital requirements were highly flawed. They were based upon the same range we saw earlier. Fannie and Freddie were inadequately regulated, but for a reason that we don't really think of, which is when I worked in the White House, the only bipartisan issue you had in homeowners was a good thing, because homeowners are voters. And you don't forget, if you want the more people who create homeownership for them, the better things with them. And so when the regulators had to decide the rating committee, Congress would not let them do it. They tied up the sheriff. The fair value accounting standards, so that's a technical issue, dead in the cycle, and the financial markets regulation was unfortunate overlapping, and a whole bunch of different agencies who couldn't get out of each other's way. So this comes from the fundamental issue. So why is regulatory failure? The result of all that is this. And every time I see this, it breaks my heart. As an American, because this is what happened in my country. Total credit outstanding as a percentage of GDP in the United States was at 350%. This is the one time I will inject a personal opinion. This is dangerous and unstable. Time of the Great Depression, we were about 150%. It spiked up right here, not because the debt went up, because the GDP went down. 20 did not go down. It was a 25% decline in GDP. We got it down post World War II to about less than 150%. Proceeded along at that level until 1980, a fateful day in American history. We'll get you a sunroof on your BMW if you come up with the answer for why that's an important day in a minute. And then we proceeded up to, inevitably over the next 30 years, up to 350%. Okay, three points that come out of this. The first is, everybody is at fault. Everybody in the United States participated in this. When I go to work, they say, find your bank to show. And I say, you want to lose the fossil, go look in the mirror first. Right? Take your own share of responsibility. U.S. household, by far the largest debtor in the United States. By far. We don't criticize them for their voters. You don't get elected by criticizing households, even though that might be the truth. Corporations are actually not that big. Compared to the Great Depression, nowhere near the same. The Great Depression was about corporate debt. The financial services industry is actually quite small. Actually, one of the smaller contributors. You add up the GSEs, which is the government sponsored enterprise, standing trade, plus U.S. government, they're the second largest contributor to the problem half the consumer. That's one of them. And one of the things I think from a public policy perspective is you can't solve a problem unless you understand it. And if you understand this is primarily, exclusively a reason, primarily caused by the banks, you got it wrong. You just don't understand the problem. You're proposing a set of solutions that are only parts of it, really looking at one of the many, many causes of the problem. Okay? Point two. Is this thing going to work for this? This is not a problem stimulus can solve. You can't address having borrowed too much and spent too much by borrowing more and spending more. Right? Stimulus can alleviate human suffering associated with the restructuring of balance sheets that take you back down to debt curve. But the upcoming experience in the U.S. economy and the global economy is going to be associated with headwinds coming from the United States as balance sheets get restructured and leverage to take out of the system. They're going to be very significant value to Dragon Economic performance in the world, and it's going to have very significant consequences, not just on when it occurs, but how it occurs and where. Third, what was the bigger bet in the United States in 1980? Did I ask you? Just kidding. Sorry. Yes, Ronald Reagan was the president and thought we'd let him do a great work in America.
He wants that summary.
No, no, no. He didn't get a chance. That's not fair. That too, but this is for economics of the great intellect. That's my guess. Right? We've been looking through this great market miracle deregulation, getting government out of the way, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The question is, as historians look back on the data, what role has been played in this great economic progress over the last 30 years by just borrowing a bunch of money and leveraging our returns? So, by the way, I'm an equal opportunity offender in this presentation. I offend my liberal friends by pointing out that consumers are involved. And I offend my conservative friends by saying, great, you have a role in it, too. Okay. So, what happens? The first thing to remember, and I've emphasized this to going, I emphasized this earlier, but let's just pause on it for a second, was the U.S. consumer entered this period unusually weak and vulnerable. This is the first, these are over here on the left-hand side, of the last five periods of expansion of the U.S. economy. There's a big period of growth now. This is the first recovery, same period in American history, in which median incomes went down. In which the average and working class Americans did not share in the benefits of the recovery. Why? Some of that due to technology, most of that due to globalization. With Americans having to get up every day to compete for jobs, people who live in the former Soviet Union, China, and India. So the American consumer entered this episode unusually weak and vulnerable. Now, there's a famous economist named Herbert Stein, something you might have heard of, who has had a famous economic dictum, which is something which is unsustainable tends to end. And it did. Americans finally took on more debt than they could service before the onset of the recession and before the associated increases in unemployment and started defaulting on their debt at levels never seen before in American history. These are the faults of unworthiness. The doctor and what will say is, good times work is fall with a 2% rate, bad times 6-9%. We construct and stress test our balance sheet to understand that kind of performance. And you can see that precisely what happens with almost every asset class in the mortgage industry, except in some rent, which went to 27% default rate. Before the recession, before the onset, before the associated increases in unemployment. This is behavior that has never been seen before in the U.S. housing market. Not even close to 27% of Americans defaulting on their loans. They finally took on more debt than they could handle and began to default. Now, it is certainly true that a whole bunch of problems in the mortgage industry around origination and disclosure and appropriateness and all the networks. No, I concede all that. I'm not a mortgage broker. I don't care. But the other message I give in the United States is if you think we should also live in a society in which at least the mortgage broker take responsibility for actions that our children should. And our children, we should teach our children to take responsibility for themselves. And our parents, not only to take on debt, but they can serve us. Then we should have to understand, individually, a major practical problem in crisis was that Americans finally took on more debt than they can serve us and began to default. That's an important part of the understanding. The result of it was, is the fault of the world we've never seen before, and the mother of all bubbles became the mother of all bubbles bursting. We're now down about 33%, actually. And one of the questions we'll get to a bit later on is kind of where are we back on trend? Where do we get to the level where the floor is under the housing economy and then important structure of the U.S. economy begins to prop itself rather than being fruitful? Okay, this is the graduate course for us. So the next thing that happened, by the way, is remember I said earlier about how the data is breaking out in very late and all the long stuff. So the housing economy started to secure in the United States. Who was the most vulnerable? Fannie and Freddie. What happened? They rolled over. These are credit default on credit to their debt. But so the federal government sees Fannie and Freddie. Late one night, Larry and I, people up all night, had to make a fateful decision to implement something called the Paulson Doctrine. Remember the Paulson Doctrine? Wipe out the equity, no more have it. Equity risk is zeroed out. Preserve the debt. Look to the system. We'll come back to this later, because that's not what they did later on. But at this point, they made the decision to preserve the debt, just like they've done with the very current situation before. Issue first is right. What do we want preferred stock? And you prefer hybrid security. More like debt, more like equity. Okay. More like debt, more like equity.
Wipe it out.
Wipe it out, right? More like, right? Okay, well, Well, what do they miss? 36 billion, that's the city. We're marking that. We're going to wipe it out, right? $36 billion of banking preferred and sold to the U.S. banking system as tier one capital. Gone. Overnight. 10% of the tier one capital, 17 U.S. banks were wiped out that moment. Another 5 to 10%, about a third of my number of U.S. banks lost their capital. 5 to 10% of their capital lost that night. Okay, so what happened? Banking systems are gone. This is a fun chart. My wife says I'm one of the few people who really likes this kind of thing, but I guess that's really good. It's a three-dimensional chart. Across the bottom of this axis right here is the change in leverage that these banks took on during this time period. So the banks over here added the most leverage. Remember that chart I showed with the bank leverage that went up to 43 times? The banks were kind of over here. Of this axis is the write-downs. They took at a percent of peak book value. Right now, at the beginning of this year, at over peak book value. So the people up here had a big loss. Okay. Now, the circle, this is the fun part. The size of the circle is the percentage, compensation is the percent of operating costs. So the biggest circle is the people pay themselves. So this is the compensation side. All right. So when we go to Washington, they don't want all banks. Money. So that's it. It's all the banking things. All money lines, big pools, things to be paid, most of you go to jail, right? That's kind of the general thing. Well, it turns out that banks live in at least three different neighbors. There's first this neighbor here. Didn't pay themselves too much. Didn't take on too much leverage. They were just concentrating the mortgage economy, and they had the biggest loss. Right? So they heard this with mortgage? Of course not. Should the people soak on the mortgage if they're prepared to service them? Of course. Whose fault is it? Probably both. Okay. Got these guys over here? First of all, I would say, don't take a bad decision to see a non-trivial relationship between leverage and compensation. Right? People took on the most amount of leverage, also paid themselves the most. But they did expose themselves to kind of losses. But these guys have. This is more about solvency. This is about the way that they funded their business. Bear Stearns, for instance, which is actually down here, didn't have that much of a lawsuit. Apparently, the Bear Stearns, every day, two guys went to work at Bear Stearns, people they never heard of, and rolled over 80 billion. Bear Stearns, they got 80 million in debt. Right? But they also had $80 billion in overnight payments. Every day, every morning, they got up and tried and solve their business and give that debt. Every day, they had to roll over $80 billion in financial statements. But then, you got these guys. Didn't take themselves too much, didn't leverage themselves too much, didn't expose themselves to solvency. No big losses. Responsible. Why are we vilified with the rest of the team? Right? And by the way, they've been the partner in the last this fun part of this technology. They've been the partner in the U.S. government in solving the problem. So Bear Stearns goes into J.P. Morgan, Washington Mutual goes into J.P. Morgan, Wachovia goes into Wells Fargo, Max City goes into PNC. No more will happen. They're all gone. By the way, see this tiny little dot right here? Bank of America. Why are they having so many problems today? Because they digested that thing. Right? And then, so this process was being in. The bank system was weakened, but the weak were going out of business. The strong were surviving and strengthening themselves. And the decision was made about a year ago to let Lehman Brothers fail. And the world, as we know, has changed for a very long period of time, in my opinion. I'm going to skip over this and just go to the next slide. This is something called the TED spread. I know everyone in this room except Hadi knows what the TED spread is. All I play in Hadi is also just teach your lunch a little bit. A lot of stuff is played in the channel, okay? The TED spread, the math of it, is the 3-month LIBOR rate, which is the charge rate that banks charge each other for overnight funds, minus the 3-month treasury rate, which is the cost of funding. The difference in TED spread is the banking system's day-to-day, minute-to-minute measure of risk in the banking system itself. I call it the heartbeat of the global economy. If you want to watch one measure of risk on a daily basis, watch the Fed spread, because it'll tell you what the banking system thinks about banking too. Now, what you can see here is that the credit markets began to back up a little default curves. I showed them in the summer of 2007. And the U.S. government intervened with a bunch of different measures to bring spreads down to levels that were high but manageable for bad money. And then the decision was made that Lehman failed. And the measure of risk was something never seen before. If the test spread is the heartbeat of the global economy, that's cardiac arrest. Right? Now, why was that a bad, why was it a bad decision? For at least two reasons. One was that it was inconsistent with actions that were taken before. The equities wiped out, the debt was not. The marketplace had learned to expect that and to anticipate that. Also, the banks were resolved not allowed to crash and burn overnight. So the inconsistency in public policy is what I was following and working on, right? That's something you avoid. You have to allow the market to be predictable and allow the market to plan accordingly. Point one. Point two, for those of us who live in New York, this might not be a good reference on the other side of the world, we could have at least tried to land the plane in the river. Remember when they landed the plane in the river in New York, right? Rather than and get the passengers crew off and minimize the collateral damage rather than let it all get written. And with the consequences that will bring. Right? It's sort of a managed failure as opposed to a crash. Alright, the result of all that, that set off something called, I call it Panic of 08. And this is sort of the horror film part of the presentation. I'll warn you in advance, this is no fun to listen to again, but we're going to see. Alright, first thing that happened was I call a run on the non-bank. Next page. The 1930s, you figured out how to run on the bank with something called FDIC insurance. But then the people that started getting put in money, something called money market funds and bond funds, which gave you a little more yield for a lot more risk, because it wasn't guaranteed. It's known in the trade of thinking of nickels in front of steamrollers. And when Lehman failed on this type of market, the biggest reserve fund, the biggest money fund, which was supposed to keep its value of the dollar, had $785 million worth of Lehman securities that were zeroed out overnight. It broke the buck. Oh my God, my dollar is only worth 95 cents. How did that happen? So as I say, and I apologize, it's a little bit dramatic here, but I say, the word went out to the land. Give me my money back. Everybody all around the world said, give me my money back. In 2 weeks, $700 billion came out of money market funds and bond funds and distributed in cash. Completely shutting down the credit market. Because that was the marginal funding for the credit funds. Rates spiked to levels never seen before. Lenders were able to work with them to lend, and the money from the credit market shut down. So if the tax spread is the heartbeat of the global economy, this is a circuit to our system. You cannot have an economy without credit circulating through the system, just like the body can have to take some of the blood circulating through the credit market completely shut down. Remember those SIFs? Structured investment vehicles? Where were they when the music stopped? Average weight of life assets, 3.7 years. Average weight of life debt, 5.5 months. Oops. There's a problem. It's technically known as a duration mismatch, so I'll guarantee there's more colorful descriptions of it that aren't appropriate for six companies. So what happened? These guys right here, that's an average life. A lot of people on the short end of this. Remember, two-thirds of 1/4 insurance. But they say, give me my money back. I want it back now. You owe it to me. So what happens, by the way? 50 people. What happens when you ask your money back? Anybody know? Anybody here submitted a redemption request during this time period? What happens when you ask your money back? They sell the security. Is that a surprise? Right? Security gets sold. Asset value collapses. And that's when we learned that Citibank had a 25% market share among SIFs. Citibank had $100 billion of off-balance sheet liability that come back on balance sheets. I didn't know that. Citibank thought, oh my God, how'd that happen? Right? Give me my money back. Money funds, the mutual funds and the hedge funds, within that quarter, $638 billion worth of redemption requests. What happens when you have redemption? They sell your securities and pay their money. So a massive tsunami of swept selling hit the global equity markets because the holders wanted their money back. Whose fault was that? Is the hedge funds and mutual funds who did the selling? It's the people who asked for the redemption. Maybe both. Okay? But the predictable result was a bonfire of advantages in which asset markets around the world actually collapsed. Right? Now, this is when, this is a very important moment. Because this is when the financial U.S. GDP was 21st in the global GDP. U.S. here was 17.5% of the world's GDP. The U.S. is okay. As a result of the reduction in housing prices, followed by the collapse in the equity market, the U.S. consumer lost $14 trillion of household net worth. $14 trillion, no, $30 to $40 trillion lost outside the United States and the rest of the developed world. Most economists will tell you that consumers spend 5 to 6% of their household net worth each year on consumption. That's about $800 billion of consumption annually that came out of the U.S. economy and the global economy. But then unemployment picked up, consumer confidence collapsed, and guess what? Americans finally started saving again, taking about another $200 trillion of consumption out of the world economy. $1 trillion of spending overnight by the U.S. consumer came out of the global economy. The entire multi-year stimulus bill is only $780 billion. It doesn't begin to replace the aggregate demand associated with the loss of $1 trillion in annual expense. Not even remotely inflationary, by the way. The return of the U.S. consumer to the marketplace, what they buy, when they buy, and at what level, is the great question that an investor has to answer today. So that's the big determinant of global economic and international economic behavior. And I'll talk a little about that later. Okay? Alright. I think everybody knows we're in the recession. Okay, so the good news is the cavalry rode the recession. Right? In the 30s, Hoover hesitated to work for finance tightness, and the economy plunged, the world economy plunged into global depression like I've ever seen before. This time it's the exact opposite. Massive, concerted, rapid action all around the world. Central bank interest rate cuts, recapitalization and liquidity injections of banks and systems. Now, this is kind of interesting. Maybe some of you know the answer. I've asked this question everywhere I've gone. I really don't know why. This is stimulus as a percent of GDP in the G20 countries. Anybody know why Saudi Arabia has the highest biggest stimulus package as a percent of GDP in the world? Anyway, if everybody knows the answer, that's something I don't know the answer. I've asked that all over the place. Saudi Arabia is the biggest stimulus package. Who knows, right? A couple of fun facts on this. One is, I think you can date the yen of Anglo-Saxon capitalism to the founding of the Bank of England in 1694, 315 years ago. This is the lowest base rate on record in 315 years. The Bank of England has never had a lower interest rate. By the way, I gave this presentation in Sweden to the investment in Walmart then. And this guy said, well, I'm really out of breakfast. And he said, the Swedish central bank was started in 1660. Said we're 30 some years older. And this, they said, by the way, this is the lowest rate we've ever had. So, lowest base rate in the history of managed capitalism. The other thing that's interesting here, and this is the other bigger undertakings in American history, fun facts. We put about $12 trillion of commitments against this problem. But the next largest undertaking in the U.S. history is World War II at $5 trillion. This undertaking is 2.5 times the size of all World War II. On the inflation adjustment basis. How are we doing it? We're doing it the old-fashioned way, we're printing the money and we're borrowing. Right? See the increase in the federal balance sheet here? That's what's inflationary. The increase in the money supply is what's going to drive inflation in the future, not stimulus spending. And you see all the borrowing that we'll have to talk about later on. This is also a three-dimensional chart. I think it's a very good point. So this chart outlines the public policy response to recession, every public policy response to recession since the Great Depression, since we learned how to manage the economy differently. This action is a degree of fiscal stimulus, how much debt we've generated. That's a degree of monetary stimulus, which is how much money supply has been put in, and the size of the bubble is how much interest rates have been reduced. But every public policy response to the Great Depression, here's 2009 and here's 2010 projected. Look at that. This is by a very wide margin. Scale still hasn't seen the most significant public policy response ever to a problem of this scale. Okay, where are we today? I'm here to announce the beginning of ending. But the ending hasn't begun. The beginning has ended, but the end has not begun. Pardon. I got that right. You can see there's some growth in the world, France, Germany, China. But UK, Italy, Eurozone, the United States is still in significant recession. The wolf spy situation here. Great U.S. consumer. Basically, if you look at this data, I'll show you, I'll go through this pretty quickly because I might be taking too much time here today, but what the data shows you is that when free fall is over, we're no longer plunging the way we were over the course of last year, and things have stabilized, but they stabilized at a very low and weak level. So you can see here that job losses in the United States upper left actually picked up again a little bit, but they slowed down and picked up a little bit, but they're still not kind of what they were seeing. Consumer confidence ticked up just a little bit, but it ticked up to a very low level. Personal income has actually gone up a little bit, finally after plunging. And household net worth is going to go up a little bit. So the consumer sector feels kind of stable. The industrial sector, kind of same thing. You can see here that commercial paper is now affordable, businesses can finance themselves. This one is very interesting. This is new orders to inventory, the ratio of the orders to inventory. It plunged to levels never seen, right? So as inventories are being liquidated at the price that kicked in. But then the inventory is at such levels that new orders vastly exceeded inventory levels, and so we had to restock inventory. But you can see now it's just gone back down again. So a big question is, has the economic performance seen over the last couple of months been significantly about the inventory restocking as opposed to fundamental growth? And this chart, which is my personal opinion, suggests that that's what's happening. Because you can see orders have gone back down again. The ratio has gone back down. The Baltic Dry Index is the earliest of early indicators. It's the rate at which freight companies, shipping companies charge to move the most basic of raw material, typically from mine to factory, and factory start back up again. By the way, I gave this presentation I was taking in Sweden, and I started explaining what the Baltic Index was, and one of the fellows said, see that on the one? I said, yes, that's the Baltic. We know what it is. I don't have to worry about that here, right? But you can see that the Baltic Dry Index really popped up when the factory started restocking themselves right through this time period, and now it's going to scale back off again, suggesting that the industrial activity starts to scale back off again, too. So the general feeling right now is that there's inventory restocking rather than a fundamental increase in growing economic activity. U.S. housing market, which is the fundamental core of the U.S. economy, you can see I've had a great plunge. We talked earlier about kind of where the trend might be, where the trend line might be after this 33% plunge. 2 months now, U.S. housing prices have gone up. Starting to feel like we're pulling out of the dive and getting back on kind of trend. Housing starts are not going down anymore, but they stabilized at a very low level. Home sales have gone up, both new and existing, but again, they've gone up to as far as still relatively low level. So it feels like there's stability in the U.S. housing market, but at a very low level. And that's the overall take here, is that it's stabilized at a very low level. The good news is you can't fall out of the basement window. Right? The good news is we're likely to go down here, absent some exogenous shock like a pandemic flu or nuclear crisis with Iran or something along those lines. But the level that we're at is very recent. Deflation is a monster. We don't have good public policy tools to deal with it, and it's both economically and socially corrupted. And you can see we've had real deflation in the major parts of the world. China, US, Europe, and India. Now, this is overall inflation. It's not that corrective thing the economists do. With my office, I don't know why they make that corrective. They take out food and energy. That's the only thing we buy. Why don't you take out what we actually consume, right? So overall inflation, hovering right about the inflationary level. Capacitization has ticked up, but it's ticked up to level, to a very low level. And same store sales, this is also a new replacement slide for a lot of data now. Same store sales are up a little bit, but most of it is cash for bunkers and also consumer household recycling. You can only go without replacing the toothpaste and toilet paper for so long. You finally got to go back and restock that to house, right? But fundamentally, very little bump in sales. And you can see, so you see where we are today. It's a good example. There's a huge amount of slack in the U.S. and global economy. 26 million underutilized workers, unemployed, dropped out of labor force, working part-time, wanting to work full-time. 26 million underutilized workers. 19 million vacant homes. A third of the freight cars and stores not being used. 14% of the world's fleet of aircraft is on the runway not being used. Hotel occupancy rate is 56%. And the value gap, the difference between what the U.S. economy could produce and what it's actually producing, is $1.2 trillion, which not coincidentally is about the same as the calculation I did earlier when I showed you that about $1 trillion of consumption would come out of the global economy as a result of what happened in the United States. So we stabilized at a very low, weak level of economic activity. We're vulnerable, though we're likely to go down again. And the big question facing us right now is, what's next? What's the duration? Okay, prognosis. I really have no idea. I can't see the future any better than the rest of out and talk to really smart people and see what they thought about the future, and I'll reflect on their back. I'm almost done, by the way. I hope that goes to one. Okay?
Great.
Okay?
It's terrible.
It's terrible. It's terrible. It's terrible. It's terrible. It's terrible. It's terrible. Is there a great and terrible way or terrible and great way?
Terrible,
too. Well, the getting is done. Okay, so this is a study that was done by a friend of mine named Ken Rogoff about financial crisis. Most recessions are induced by trade adjustments or inventory adjustments. And you can bounce back pretty quickly from that. But there's a handful of recessions that have been induced by financial crises. Remember the chart I showed you with the huge spike in debt and then having to go down the other side from the restructuring on the balance sheets. Think about that as being a national experience following the recession being a huge headwind for the recession. So what Ken did and Carmen Reinhart is they isolated those 14 incidents and then looked at four variables to see what happened. Oops. I put the wrong button. Let's see if I can just do that. Okay, that's easy to see. They looked at housing prices, equity values, unemployment rate, GDP per capita, peak to trough change, and duration. So if you look at the leading indicators, housing prices, historically they go down 36% during recessions like these, financial prices induced recessions. We're now down, actually, this needs to be updated, we're now down about 33%. Interestingly enough, equity values were down 56%. At the end of the first quarter, equity values were down exactly 56% around the world. And they rallied since then to be down 25%. It says something about the stage of the rally. But you can see that forward economic indicators suggest, leading economic indicators suggest that asset values are going down about where they go in these recessions. Unfortunately for the United States, you get about 7 percentage points change in unemployment. And we're only about 70% of the way through that, which means unemployment will continue to rise and continue to be a very significant social and political issue in the United States. The more interesting for this discussion is duration. On average, it takes 6 years for housing prices to recover from 3 years into that. It takes 3.4 years for equity values to recover about halfway through that. Right? It takes 4 or 5 years for unemployment to recover only 2 years into that, only 40% of that. So if you look at asset values for a minute, what you convince yourself is that there's another 18 to 36 months, call it 24 months, during which the conditions have to be created for sustained growth and balance, in which balance sheets have to be repaired to repair for all sectors of society support, not economic activity, where you can have the basis for not economic activity. So my personal view is that I'm not making a prediction, but my personal view, I've got $80 billion in revenue and 270,000 employees I'm responsible for in the companies that we own. And what I'm saying is, it's a good time to buy. We were talking about it earlier today, right? Good time to buy, but you've got to be prepared to sustain yourself through another at least 2 years of economic activity, this low and weak level of performance, for the conditions created for worldwide growth. So right now, the big issue is not how much farther down we go, but the duration of our experience at this level of performance. The United States, unemployment's got another 3 years here to go, and that assumes things like Fed growth, which is unlikely at this minute. Which means that unemployment will continue to be not just a big social issue, which is the most important issue for me, obviously, the human suffering that goes along with people losing their jobs and associated dignity, but will be a political issue, a very important political issue for the next 2 elections. And will influence significantly the kind of policy actions that are taking the United States to address. Okay, that's historical reason. I won't belabor this, but this is what I call the institutional reason related to IMF forecast for global economy. And it's interesting, this is the people on my team are actually day-to-day predictions. The structure of this chart is the top line of 2008 actual, 2009 forecast, 2010 projected, and the 2014 projected, which is the trend growth beyond the recession, 5 years from now. The globe, the advanced world, and the emerging world. And so this is probably a whole bunch, we can spend a lot of time on this, but I'll get through this quickly. But you can see the projection for the overall globe looks pretty good. 1.4% down this year, 3% up next year, 5% trend growth. Done deal. Where do I sign up for that experience? Looks okay to me, right? The problem is, where is it located? Advanced world, IMF now signed off the roll call deal. We got 2 losses before they sustain the world. And then trend growth is 2.6% on the other side of the cycle. Think of that as opposed to about 3.25% within the last 30, 25-ish years to a certain standard. Think of that 0.75% that's the result of deleveraging. Not being able to leverage our reserves, we're having deleveraging. Okay? And in the emerging world, you can see here, bouncing back to growth pretty quickly. Why? No financial services crisis. And very healthy consumer balance sheet and the emergence of middle class. So it's the consumer drag plus the financial industry as a channel of credit, which is weakened in the first world and the advanced world, developed world, and strong in the developing world are the two reasons why these economies will continue to grow very, very rapidly while the advanced economies will sputter, which means that unemployment will continue to grow at very high levels for a very meaningful period of time. At current rate of unemployment, if the United States job market grew in the next 10 years like it did in the 90s, which is not unlikely here, we will get back to 5% unemployment until 2017. Right? The result of that is unemployment is going to be a very big social political issue in the United States. Here's the chart I was showing you. I'm going to skip over this. You can see it takes until 2017 to get back to 5% unemployment at growth rate for life in the States. So unemployment is going to be a very big issue in the United States. Okay, geopolitical news. I put this back in for Brooklyn. They picked it up with money, so I think that's some policy meaning you'd like to talk about this, like me. First of all, the developed world countries are turning inward. Let national, buy national, hire national, keep the foreigners out. All the rise of nativism that you see that happen in China is very evident. Sarkozy said, let them fail, save the need. Right? The model of free market capitalism that the United States used to lecture the world about is under a cloud. I mean, the United States is now making owns automobile companies and banks. We're in no position to lecture the French on markets anymore. Right? We're going to restructure. We have to restructure the multilateral financial institutions. We're going to have the G20 countries are dealing with that. U.S. global economic power is eroding. And this is part of the people in the military in the United States. You have another line here in Doha as well. Very concerned about, because we don't have the money anymore to do anything that's not required. Think about the whole thing that I think done in the world from something as benign as the Marshall Plan to something as part of the micro reviews and that incubation of Iraq. And we don't have money to do anything. The United States doesn't appear to force restraint because we've already spent all that money. Right? We can't be the aggressive actor in the world that did have. This is, the last time the United States was dependent on foreign capital for a lifestyle was when we sent Ben Franklin to France to borrow money for the revolution. Right? This is now the new lender. Right? And the massive deficit the United States is running will be a huge problem. I said to my friends in Congress, it was kind of amusing to me to watch the legislature spend money that they don't have, they have to go borrow. And support the regulated financial service industry that is they can't control. The new regulator in the global economy is the capital for the United States, is the capital to get the people who are buying the capital that's being imported not by the United States to fund the budget deficit. Here's the deal we're being offered today, right? Which is, we're going to lose money as far as the United States, and you're going to lend us some money to finance that at nearly 0% interest rate. Now, Alex, if I came to you, I had a little bit of money, I managed for a QI. If I came to you, QI, I'd offer you that deal, what would you say? No, thank you. Right? And so we're going to have to pivot the fiscal responsibility, I think, very, very quickly to finance these budget deficits. The result is, do we have to take a patient off life support before it can support itself independently? And is that, because if people tell you we're having a great depression, it was not, there wasn't one depression, but it was two simultaneous, two sequential, pardon me, recessions, which were, the second was caused by tightening in 1935, when the Roosevelt bought the recession door, and we punched back into the recession again. Clearly accelerated the relative rise of China. They are now, China has gone from being needing capital to being the wealthiest country in the world. They really have nearly over almost $3 trillion of foreign exchange reserves. And they have a view, which is something which I debated in this part of the world too, that they sort of have a huge advantage because even though they've imported capital, you got that capital, they're not to worry about this other thing called democracy. And so they can do what they want to do, when they want to do, how long it takes. So they think they've got a governance advantage over the United States. and that, and I think, by the way, my personal view, we'll see, my personal view is, just like during the Cold War, there was a contest between capitalism and communism, I think the next 25 years will be characterized by a similar debate between autocracy and democracy, as we've already heard around the country. We'll see. Okay, this is, I think, almost the last slide. Here's the side visually in the crowd. What's the answer? The answer is, of course, innovation. I call innovation will set you free. It's very clear that R&D drives innovation, innovation drives productivity, productivity drives GDP growth. So the answer is, just like it was in the 70s when I was in college and I was told to be the first generation to get into Dallas Mobile, the answer, of course, is actually in what I do for the 1990s. This is my shameless commercial silver. The good news is, as you would expect, the technology economy has bounced back much more rapidly than the rest of the economy. The better news is, and this is the very last slide, is that we're on the cusp of the greatest IT trend of our lifetime. First one was PCs. Think Microsoft and Apple. Starting early 80s. Second one was networking, taking all those PCs and stitching together, think system. The third was the internet, taking all those network PCs and creating platforms and then they interact and write into some kind of interesting, important ways. Broadband wireless mobility is by far bigger than any other trend. Give you a couple examples. Watch. One, 30 years into the PC trend, there are a billion PCs at use in the world. There are already 3.3 billion handsets. There's already an addressable market 3 times the size, just a few years into this thing, as there is 30 years into the PC trend. Secondly, bandwidth. People here, I'm sure, are familiar with YouTube, which is just one part of Google. Did you know that YouTube today uses more bandwidth just by itself than the entire internet used at its peak in 2001? So the video is bandwidth all. Right, so Cisco here predicts that the use of bandwidth is going to increase by a factor of 66 times over the next 5 years. So if any of you visit New York and you're wondering why you're, even though you have 5 bars and your phone doesn't work, do you know why that is? The Apple iPhone. So if you think about a cell phone takes 1 increment of internet bandwidth, a BlackBerry takes 3 increments, and an iPhone now takes an eight to 10. Because of all the applications that are running across and increasingly complex applications running across systems. So massive increases are required in the network. And there's huge supply chains, technology, software, and services that go into making the gizmos and making the network. And also huge amounts of software, content and services that run across those networks. It is by far the biggest IT trend of our lifetime and has a real potential to carry us in the developed world beyond this crisis. I'm all done. Thank you.
Thank you.
How do you know that?
Well, why don't you think you want to back a little bit into that? And why don't we take some questions? We invite you all to ask three questions, trying to under a minute or two to time up, and please state your name and your affiliation. So if anyone wants to raise their hand, I'll take count. Or one back here. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, Haji, for an excellent presentation. While you all enjoyed our lunch, you went to work. We sympathize with you for that. My name is Ryan Sola. I'm in the Kerala Department Embassy. My question is, with time, we have become more sophisticated in documenting the economy, in anticipating it. We have much more tools, better understanding. Economics is now a much better science. Then why was this crisis not anticipated well in time? And why wasn't a corrective measure taken? Thank you.
That is an extraordinarily good question, and one I don't have an answer to. But it also is one of the slides I skipped over, which I shouldn't have. You know, are we at the end now? Can we go back to the page? Yeah, the great moderator. You know, well, let me just talk about this. The great moderator. So what basically happened was, I've given this presentation to the boards and senior staff of some of the largest banks in the world who were at the center of this crisis. And I went there sort of like a peer review to kind of show them what I thought happened and ask them if they agreed. And almost always, the first or the last question that we ponder for a very long period of time is the one you just asked. It's the behavioral question, which is how do we all behave this way even though it's reasonably obvious what was happening? I will let you know, I think that in my organization, I studied this stuff very carefully, and I, in fact, you were talking today earlier, very substantial in our patients that have 06 and 07 because of what I concerned about. I would say that would be really hard to do because I was really just stuck at the guard part. Everybody else thought the world was, you know, going to be benign. So let me show you, this chart here, go back. Yeah, that's good. So this is meant to get, this something, we went through something called the Great Moderation. Right. And everybody talks about how the liquidity part of the global economy. So thank you, Susan. This line here is something called the funding and market liquidity index, which is the measure of the price of liabilities, how much it costs to borrow and do something as well. And you see the result of this period of sustained liquidity in the global economy. Funding the index went down to levels we've never seen before for a sustained period of time. The result of that was that asset volatility, now this is a basket of all assets around the world, and it shows their volatility. Volatility, for those of you who aren't financial weenies like me, is sort of the up and down change. It's not up or down, but something that goes like that. So that's the measure of volatility. You can see that asset volatility was eventually brought down through this time period to low levels, never there. The world seemed benign. The future seemed nothing but bright. We're all lulled into a low period of great liquidity, a sense that risk isn't taken out of the world. And we began to behave in ways across all sectors of society, all across the world. In ways we look back on now and say, what were we thinking? So it's human behavior. And no matter how good our analytics pick up, no matter how much we study history, we're all still, as my wife points out to me all the time, going to be human. And make mistakes, right? And so that's in the nature of human nature that we're going to behave like this over time. Mind you. By the way, we want, there's another point I make, is that this was a result of an overreaction to September 11, 2001, the equity crash, right? So in the seeds of each crisis, the solution to each crisis are planted in the seeds of the next crisis. Right? So the question is, what are we doing today, right, that inadvertently creates the conditions for the next crisis? Right? That's the subject for another debate, but I think of it as the three D's in the United States: debt, demographics, and the dollar. Those are the three looming issues for my view in the world today. I don't know if that answers your question. Unless there's not a really good answer to it, except to say, well, thank you.
Thank you again. Thank you. My question is a question that looms in the mind of any kind of government official these days. I think what we've seen is the period of Reaganomics and Thatcherism just coming to an end. And, you know, with it's not only Sarkozy that thinks that laissez-faire is out the door. I think it's in the mind of any kind of government official that uses this one in promoting government interference in the economy. How do you see the economy and the government's role in the economy coming forward? This is my first question. But my second question is, how do governments go out of this managerial position that they have themselves in now, with all of these assets becoming directly owned and managed by government? Isn't this the same for another crisis to come?
You know, I had to travel halfway around the world to hear the two best questions. These are two important questions, right? The audience is like, in the United States, don't get to the nub of these things so quickly, so this is really great. Let me take the first one first, which is that U.S. government is about 20% of our GDP. The 17 to 20%, depending upon the year. And the financial services industry is defined very, very broadly to include real estate as 8%. So there's 72% of our GDP that engaged in none of this. Right, so the question is, how do you solve the problem without putting the baby out of the bathwater? Right, that's the big issue, right? So we can't interpret this as a failure of capitalism. in some fundamental way. We had a financial crisis. We didn't have a city of capitalism because, you know, in my world, we're just going to work every day creating all sorts of new gizmos and technology to improve people's lives. What did I do wrong? You know, I mean, why should I always just be put in jail with the rest of the guys? And just, you see what I mean? So that's the thing that they hear here, everybody. I think what we need to, and that's where this notion that free market economics under some sort of cloud really concerns me, because it doesn't get the problem. And it's one of the reasons why I've done this, because if you look at the problem, what you really see is that the biggest offenders were financial services industry, the U.S. consumer, and the U.S. government. Right, so we need to think about amending those three sorts of behavior without compromising the capacity for nations all around the world to engage in investment in innovation. So I think we had to narrow it down to that and not over marginalize it. Right, and I can talk about that in the whole issue around financial services regulation. I say one of my biggest criticisms, other than, you know, those of us who have seen middle management in the Clinton White House are now senior management in the Obama White House. These guys are all friends of mine now, so I'm not going to talk to people they've been doing this. And I'll tell you what I tell them, and I will never tell anybody what they tell me back. But whatever, what I tell them, I go and open book. But I say you can't criticize business broadly. Right? Because what you're doing is undermining confidence in the whole business community. When you look at that banking chart that I showed you, a lot of the banks actually handled themselves very well and deserve praise for what they did, and we're real partners in solving the problem. And so I think you have to take a nuanced, informed view of who the good guys and bad guys are, and what the problem works, how it works, rather than paint a particular block for us. I guess the overall big government can be very careful. It's very easy just to, you know, paint into a block for us. To answer your second question, it's a really good point. The financial services industry is being a very straightforward thing for the U.S. government to eventually sell a share of GDP by the bank, because they can't have high yield curve, the banks borrow very low, and they can do the carry trade and earn their way out of it, and that kind of thing. Yeah, so that's going to be an issue of coal itself. That capital coming back will be a pretty straightforward thing to do. The bigger issue we'll grapple with is kind of, do we allow ourselves to get into this situation again? And there's a whole bunch of things around that which we don't have time today to talk about. I'm happy to talk about them. What do you do? It addresses the issue of kind of, are institutions too big to fail? If they are, do you tax them? Do you impose them to charge for the best purpose of that? Are you prevent them getting that point? And what kind of resolution authority do you have? Because part of the problem is that federal government felt that they didn't have adequate tools and statutory, rights or abilities to go in and resolve some of these things like Lehman Brothers, because they could resolve banks, but they couldn't resolve investment banks. You know what I mean? So they didn't have the same tools to deal with Lehman Brothers that they had to deal with there's a learning about kind of how you manage it, how you regulate it, who gets regulated, all those things that you can do. On the rest of it, the more challenging thing is, for instance, the automobile industry. I was actually for the bail of the automobile industry, something I would have historically been way against, because the crisis caused something which was a gradual disappearance of an industry in the United States into a crisis that was just falling out of money. You had to put a stop to it. It was almost like a job thing. Put a stop to it and let it. So the question is, how do we allow for the managed decline of industries like the automobile industry, knowing that they're going to essentially go away or be much smaller or be substituted for by other entrepreneurs who can develop cars that are more fuel efficient, green, all this kind of thing? How do you allow the process of destructive change in capitalism to occur in a way that, in a more normalized environment, after you have taken the inconsistent action, say, the auto companies are not taking the steel? How do you create those conditions to do that? That's a really big and important threat. But I think I think that's a bigger problem, especially now that unemployment remains very high. Right, because what you're starting to hear coming out of rumblings from Congress and United States right now is last year's about Wall Street, this year's about Main Street. And which means they're going to try to preserve jobs in a way that I think is destructive in the long term, but politically catnip in the short term. So that's going to be the big issue, even with the politics of how to transition back to a more normalized economy in a quick period of time, three, four. Did that answer your question? Thank you. Good question. So after those two great questions, I challenge anybody to come up with anything nearly that good comment. If this is a BMW on the table.
Is it an X5 or an X6? Over here.
Christy Billing, I'm just here for myself, not representing the company. As a kind of classified tech geek, I've been in the technology industry for about 20 years. I'm just wondering, given that you said that it was really the U.S. consumer that was one of the largest impact on kind of credit borrowing, that was a lead up to this thing, and still from an attitudinal standpoint in the U.S., is substantial. You talk about the growth of technology, and when I was a kid, you know, was who had the Ditto jeans or the later on the 90s that was the thing, and now you've got, who's got the iPhone, the latest iPod. When I was back in the U.S. this summer, and I was talking with friends that were under financial duress, you know, a lot of them were so bought into technology, those were the expenses that they weren't willing to give up, often to the tune of, you know, several $100 a month just in fixed subscriptions to, you know, the equivalent of Showtime here, you know, their cable services, their whatever. How do you see, given that there are wonderful advances in technology, but particularly in kind of the base standard consumer level, it's taking up more and more of their basket of goods and taking up a huge percentage compared to just putting food on the table. Money that right now might be better spent doing other things in order for them to, you know, save and move forward to be able to afford it later on. I guess, what do you see from a behavioral change?
Yeah, well, the epigram I use for this is that, you know, people have been to understand that the baby boom has determined a lot of American economic, political, and cultural trends through its life. And the epigram I use, the baby boom has lost a third of its net worth on the eve of its retirement. Right. So how does that behavior change? It's very clear that a lot of consumer discretionary and durable consumption will, in my view, be fundamentally changed. People own their cars longer. Well, on average, they replace the car 2.5 to 3 years, the car lasts 5 to 6 years. So they will lengthen out the purchase cycle of the car. No doubt about it. There are lots of, there's a lot of substitution people reading at less, buying in more, buying, you know, classic economics, more steak, more hamburger, less steak, because all that sort of stuff happens in the economy. As my wife said the other day, you know, soap is soap. I don't know why it has to be designer soap is perfume. It's just soap. You know, so there's all sorts of substitution effects happening throughout the economy. There are really changing reducing behavior. There's a whole bunch of behavior that was, we thought was recession resistant, because now, not gambling. For the last several cycles, gambling has been a place to be because it kept up the recession. Now gambling is, you know, a lot of business, a lot of business, and I think a lot of things is totally significant. That's a very fundamental change. One of the things I know, I ran into a friend of mine in the lobby of a hotel that he's running this Tribeca Film Festival today. She said that, and I had not been talking to her, and I told her that, you know, one of the interesting things is, one of the few things, one of the few record of winning Congress, I said, boom, more people are going to boom. Alright, so some things you don't expect, but fundamental changes in consumer behavior, I think, will last for a very long period of time. So it's with housing, durable, discretionary, not just basic, not, you know, toothpaste, toilet paper, and that kind of thing. And so, one of the things I like about technology is I do think that regardless of the period of economic cycle, you come out with an iPod or an iPhone, people want it. People buy it, and they'll consume something less to get that. So things that transform people's experience, that broaden their scope of activity. I mean, you know, there's a couple of telecom companies over the last in India and China that are adding tens of millions of customers a month during this crisis because they're getting connectivity to people who were never connected to a global economy before. Take cost out for businesses, do mission critical services, all those sorts of things. So, where people are being offered real innovation and real change in experience and real abilities to increase their personal business productivity, which is increasing spending. Think of it, a big shift that's occurring now. Big winners and losers as consumption fundamentally changes and gets more oriented towards the sorts of things that you talked about, you know, oriented away from the type of things that have driven the U.S. economy and have driven the U.S. even the world economy over the last 30 years. And so that's why I think maybe we'll finish where we started here, which is one of the key conclusions that I reached when I was renewing my intellectual property business analysis was that I have to think very, very differently about the role of the U.S. consumer as an actor in the global economy and adjust my expectations accordingly and my investment practices accordingly. And the actual real answer to that is something you've got to pay for.
Does your bill get overwhelmed? Question.
Oh, there's more on here. We have a few more minutes left right here.
Thanks, Brian. That's Sam Soul. Thank you. Wow. So there are a couple of different trends, a couple of different ideas that you presented. One of them was cheap money. One of them was divergence between the developed economies and the developing economies. And I'm just thinking out loud here, but cheap money is something that got us into this problem in the first place. And that cheap money is back again with a vengeance. So that's one thing that I think should worry people, at least in Serenity. The other thing is that there seems to be a, you know, facts and figures that talk about such trends of growth in the advanced economies, which spell deflation. But you've got, on the other hand, a lot of liquidity and growth in the emerging markets that spells inflation. And a couple of smart investors out there that we've spoken to have really started to position themselves for a very inflationary world, driven by, you know, the monetary and fiscal stimuli that are going on, but especially the destruction of supply, and, you know, whether, you know, energy supply or production capacity supply that's been going on since the credit crisis hit. And I'm starting to wonder whether that spells stagflation in Europe and the U.S., which is something we haven't seen since the 70s, and hyperinflation in emerging economies. Just wondering whether, you know, that's a scenario that anybody's thought about.
You know, your guess is as good as mine on that. I mean, we all just now have opinions about the future, right? And there certainly are very, very good arguments for that scenario that you just laid out. I am less concerned about inflation than other people for two reasons. One is, in the short term, there's a huge amount of slack in the global economy and taking that slack out. Now, that might be possible inflation, whether it's a particular demand to fly the demand out and maybe the energy consequence. But overall, I don't see the cause for inflation in 3 years. I don't see the cause for inflation in the near term because of that. Secondly, as I said earlier, the loss of aggregate demand means, relative to the stimulus spending, means the stimulus itself is not inflationary. What's really inflationary is the growth of the money supply. And I think we can take the money, we have much more control over that. You can take the money supply out of the economy as the velocity rises, global money rises, and so there's some less concern about that. And in the long run, we have proven that we have robust policy tools to deal with inflation. We did that in the 70s, for instance, and we can do it again. It's very painful, but it can be done again. We know how to deal with that. Of course, the Japanese have proved that we don't really have robust policy tools to deal with inflation. So I would take the risk of inflation out of the people. So I'm less concerned about inflation than other people are. What I'm very concerned about is all the debt that's being built up as a result of the stimulus spending that we've done in the United States, and that debt stays out there. We potentially have that as a big tax increase in the future. And the interest associated with that. And then the demographics that are hitting the tidal wave, hitting the beach, not just the United States, but also in China, Japan, and Europe. We're going to get to the point where there's going to be something like 1.2 workers in those parts of the world supporting every retiree. And the cost of health care and sanitary retirement is going to be enormous. That's a huge burden. And that's why we were saving at the end of the Clinton administration. When we set the solution at the beginning of the Clinton administration to save at the end, to save the chance of that demographic time bomb, which is the food we forgot about. So I think that's the bigger issue, and that has, of course, all interact with inflation, of course. But that means that you think about continuing to attract the capital absent fundamental changes in the behavior of the U.S. government, tax increases, spending cuts, so things get so mass in order. What you think is that there are very, very big consequences for interest rates and the dollar exchange rates in the future. Mind you, think that's we're more likely to have a dollar problem than an inflation problem. Right? We're more likely to have sustained high interest rates to attract capital and a stagnation problem, not an inflation problem. Personally, but we're almost making guesses in those areas laid out much more thoughtful and more people than I am subscribed to.
there were some hands raised over here. Why don't we take
one last question?
Why don't we take if we can take
two more questions?
Two questions, and then
okay.
The questions. Over here.
Just one small question. One of the slides you put a map. Three countries you portray as expanding the green: Syria, Egypt, and Kenya.
You're very astute. I have no idea. You tell me. No, but what that was the those behind that project, not mine. And so I haven't studied those questions. How many don't have a fossil? Point of view about that. So this is what they're projecting right now. I would assume, I don't know about Kenya, I know very little bit about Syria, and you can look up the answer for you, but I assume it's about localization. I assume it's about a series of policies that are meant to encourage growth, and that's kind of what they're expecting. And in fact, the other key indicia that the IMF now is using for growth or not is whether or not you have a functioning, whether your banking system is in crisis or not, and whether your household has a huge amount of household debt. But I assume that there are those better shape in that part of the world than others around. I'll look it up for
you. I'm going to take a question here.
Professor Vitas Bori from Qatar University. And thank you very much for the informative lecture. I have one comment and one question, small question, but one of the comments is, don't you think that the corporate governance, for example, has a big role in this crisis? And the structure of the board of directors really working with the CEOs, sometimes against the small shareholders, and taking decisions, basically, mostly financial decisions, which are really just to show off, maybe sometimes greed or to just reach for certain position and maximizing their own worth rather than the rest of the people instead, not even just the shareholders. The second thing is the financial innovation. Is there any control over these financial innovations in the state? And what's the role of the central bank in monitoring such financial innovation by the banking sector? My third comment or question, do you think that the value of the dollar will keep sliding now, or what is the position of the dollar in the coming future?
Right. Okay, well, I think we just talked about the dollar thing, which I'm not going to predict the dollar. When I was working in the Clinton administration on the second sector, Mr. Rubin would say, only here to say was a strong dollar is in the interest of the U.S. economy. I learned that never to predict the dollar. But I have been focusing on kind of a long-term dollar issue, which I'm not surprised by the short-term weakness in the dollar. But the markets tend to anticipate the future price changes today.
What if the other countries decided that they don't want really the dollar to be the main currency?
I think the most important thing to happen in the world today, by the way, from currencies is not pricing oil in the basket of currencies on the dollar, but actually the Chinese being willing to take responsibility and float their currency. Because the big distortion in the global economy today is the management of the Chinese currency. That's the big distortion. And that's what's preventing a lot of the Chinese currency is allowed to float and appreciate. A lot of the issues in the United States have to go away, right? Because the goods in China will be more expensive, China will consume more in the United States less than Vietnam. So that's the big issue. I know that in the oil producing countries, you see the dollar more of an issue of weakness because of the way oil is priced. And that's the big issue, too. I think, personally, it would be a good thing over the long run for the United States not to be a unique holder. Not to be a financial unit superpower. It would be good to have everybody take responsibility very broadly, because if you do price well in the basket, or if you do have a responsibility, all of a sudden you have a very different stake in the world. And you get a new banking liability yourself. So I think that's a very good thing, because the more people we get involved with stakeholders, the better off we'll be, my personal view. With respect to the governance, the thing that you have to be careful about is that if you take maybe the number's slightly different. If you take the government out, 72% of 80% or 90% of the economy, economic access was not released at all in contributing to this crisis.
I'm sorry, I was talking about the corporate government.
Yeah, no,
controlling both of.
Yeah, I understand, but we're only talking about 10% of the actors measured by GDP in the entire economy. The 8% of the 80% that's private, taking out government, only 8% is in financial services and real estate. We're only talking about 10% of the private economy. So again, we don't want to throw everybody in jail for the actions of a small number. So I'm not sure if it was corporate governance itself as an issue, broadly described. It might well be more compensation practices in the financial services industry. You see, that contributed to it. That's what why people are focused. What that means is an appropriate thing to focus on. My personal thing, we talked earlier about some of the regulatory response. I think what you don't want to do is to discourage people from becoming wealthy, because it's the only path to GDP creation is through wealth creation for certain sectors. I don't mean you want to say you can't make X amount of money. I think you want to say that the incentives around the creation of that wealth have to be ones that are constructive for all of us. And the structure of the compensation is one that doesn't encourage excessive risk taking, like unrestricted stock as opposed to options, those sort of things. I think you should approach the structure but not the amount. Because if you approach the amount, you're creating wrong incentives, you're just engaging in some class warfare. So I think that's kind of how I think about it. From a financialization point of view, it's very, very clear that the complexity of the financial instruments got ahead of the ability of people to manage them. And then the associated aggregate complexity of the financial institutions themselves got way ahead of the ability of people to manage those. No, there's no doubt about that. On the other hand, you again don't want to throw the baby out with bathwater, because we're talking about now in the United States about, for instance, regulating derivatives. It turns out that energy-producing companies, food-producing companies, a whole bunch of physical producers actually use those derivatives quite constructively to manage their risks. Right? So if you're making processed food, you can go buy corn in the forward market to make your high-fructose corn syrup to produce your food, and they can manage stuff. There's nothing to matter with that. So it turns out that the biggest people lobbying against some of the derivative legislations are the physical producers who actually need to manage the business. And that they find the innovations that have been created extraordinarily helpful. So I think you've got to be very, very careful as you sort your way through stifling innovations that are coming out because of what happened behind it. Desmond, we talked a little earlier, some folks here, about the work we've done in Silver Lake around creating technologies that have allowed people to buy and sell stocks online in their individual institutions that have very substantially reduced the cost for people. Trading either institution or individuals, and you want to be able to encourage that kind of innovation that's good for everybody. So you have to be very, you have to look at a case by case basis on kind of what sort of innovation adds to systemic risk. In other words, here's what I think about it, and we'll close with this, which is that there are two rationales for financial services regulation. Either you're an actor that creates systemic risk, or you have to protect consumers. There are no other rationales. I don't know anybody who knows anything articulate to me. And so anything else is just regulation because you don't like the person. You don't like the actor and you want to curb their activities. But so if you focus on kind of what creates systemic risk and where consumers need to be protected because they don't have the capacity to make good financial decisions in a very complicated world, I think that's the place to focus regulation. And that's how I think about it, rather than innovation or not. Personally.
Well, the use of innovation.
That's a very different issue, though. The one thing that you learn from a long career in business, not my battle, but long career business, is you can't fraud and theft. That was just someone who was acting in a fraudulent way. It wasn't because he was misusing innovation. He was just basically breaking the rules of his own institution. looked at for something very different than the systemic risk that these large organizations create. Thank you very much for having me. Thank you very much for, my wife has had to travel a very long way to get people listening. And I think I established that today. But thank you very much for taking the time. And I thank you for all you wonderful bookies here in Doha. It's a great, great thing to do.
Thank you, Blaine. It was a great having you. And the staff of the Virgin Star Center putting this together, particularly Ms. Holly and Rachel, who put this event together. This is the last event with us today. For sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thank you.